rivers till I reach you. Rivers and roads, all rivers.
And you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. Tufts Free Forum, commercial free, community based radio. And we're about to segue into Socialist Alternative Radio, 2 hours of talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Today we'll be interviewing the author of Kill It to Save It, Corey Dolgan. And for all you new listeners, Socialist Alternative Radio is on every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are about talking about socialism and related matters from a very partisan viewpoint. We believe in the need for a system change, the need for democratic socialism, and the ways to get there are varied. And we support unions and political parties, new political parties to the left of the Democratic Party, hopefully, and all sorts of other initiatives. We'll be talking about May 1st today a little bit, if we have time, and how International Workers' Day went. And we really appreciate your listenership. Go to WMFO.org for listening online and listening to archive shows. We'll have at least one show per month archived. And you can also try FenianRising.org. That is a Facebook page at this point that has been downloaded a lot of our shows thanks to Fenian Rising. And they're also on Facebook, Fenian Rising, not FenianRising.org. I believe the website's not working anymore. I'm not sure. Anyway, enough introduction. We're waiting for our guest, Corey Dolgan. He wrote Kill It to Save It, an autopsy of capitalism's triumph over democracy. Just came out. He gave a reading at the Harvard bookstore the other night that I attended. This is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. By the way, for new listeners, when we talk about the place where we're reporting on or talking about or, you know, relating some experience from, usually in this area around Greater Boston, Eastern Massachusetts, Rhode Island, that sort of thing. We do sometimes, you know, say specifically where we're calling from, where we're, you know, acting from or talking about, because this show does go out internationally. We've had some great feedback nationally, internationally, beyond our region. Again, go to WMFO.org to listen to the, listen by computer. And we appreciate all that feedback. Go to our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio, if you want to give us some more. And we do post a lot to our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio, a lot of interesting stuff. Today, for example, we're waiting for the results of the French elections between pro-capitalist centrist Macron and a right-wing populist who's been sort of whitewashed from her Nazi past, her fascist past, Marine Le Pen. They both suck. The French basically have the same kind of choice we had in the last election here for president, and not much to vote for. And so a lot of French are considering abstaining. A lot will do some sort of strategic vote for Macron, but some people just can't bring themselves to do that. And entering our studio is the subject of our show today. Well, you're not the personal subject of our show, but his work, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy, Corey Dolgan. In interest of full disclosure, I've known Corey for a long time. And we'll have a Boston University in that poetry workshop.
That's right.
Yeah, by Starbuck, George Starbuck. That was a great class. So Corey's in the studio, in the house. You're at mic 3, 2, 3, or 4. Pick your poison. This is 4. You can do 4. I can do 4.
Yeah.
And I'll turn that mic on right now, and we'll see. You need the headphones, and you can play with it right there, I think. And welcome, Corey.
I don't expect any callers on my phone.
Don't worry. We're informal here. If a call comes in, we'll share it with our listening audience.
I bet you will. And my daughter asking, where's lunch?
And so, you're on Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We've been on the air about 10 years here. You've been on once before, which was great.
That's right.
But you've there's some august company that you're part of, Steve Early. That guy, Zweig, you know that guy, Michael Zweig. He's probably retired now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of all the famous people. The guy, Dan Labatt, when he was running for Senate in Ohio as a socialist.
Yeah.
and various other luminaries. I'm sorry if I left anyone out there. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm also here with you, and I consider you an august luminary.
You might want to talk a little closer to the mic, okay. Not to be an obnoxious. Radio is very easy. Like people come on the show and they're nervous. I'm like, why are you nervous? You just talk.
It's true.
There's only two enemies: dead air.
I didn't have to shower.
No.
This is great.
There's dead air. We don't like that. So if I talk too much, it's because you're not talking.
That's right.
And then there's technical malfunction. But other than that, it's easy peasy. You
nudity
know.
Is fine.
Nudity is fine. But, you know, I have an anecdote about that. Clark University, where I do some organizing now for Socialist Alternative, mm-hmm. where I help, they lost their FCC license way back in those crazy 60s and 70s because mm-hmm. a couple DJs or a DJ and a partner did the thing on the air, and it was and the FCC got heard about it and was like, yank, no more.
Well, it's funny that they heard about it.
They literally heard about it, yeah. it is. But you know, I think last time you were here, the station was very hippy dippy and 60s, and it's been cleaned up and professionalized a bit.
I'm appalled.
Do you like it?
I'm appalled at how clean and neat.
Yeah. And there's other studios now, and the station is getting more professional. I think in generally in a good way. And so Kill It to Save It. I have to admit, I haven't had time to read it. I read the last chapter last night.
Ooh, wow.
That's as far as I got.
You did the
first chapter. Well, because you started at the beginning at the reading. Corey did a reading at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This does go out beyond the area, so I'm putting us in the place. And it was really good. Full house.
Absolutely.
And really good. Yeah.
Standing room only.
Yeah.
And remind me later to make some shameless plugs for upcoming book talks.
But well, I also want to hear shameless plugs for your other works, because I'm only familiar with one, the Hamptons one.
Right.
So what else have you written besides Kill It to Save It?
Let's see. I certainly recommend anything I've written. Certainly for anyone suffering with a sleep disorder. But I have written a textbook called Social Problems, A Service Learning Approach. I've been doing a lot of civic engagement, community organizing around teaching and research. We actually have another new book out called the Handbook for Community Engagement and Service Learning. So for folks in the education world, they might take a look at that. I highly recommend having libraries purchase that book, because they're way too expensive for individuals to buy.
Because it's like a textbook? Is that
right? It's more of a reference book. I wouldn't use it for a full class unless the class was about community engagement. But I think with the triumph, and I'll put that in quotation marks, the triumph of civic engagement on college campuses, this is somewhat of an elixir that suggests there are some very good practices in service learning and community-based research, but we look historically and institutionally at the politics of that, where we find most of the movement lacking. So I think it's an important book in that area.
So that's two, right?
Two.
Then there's the Hamptons book?
The Hamptons book.
And what was the exact title? I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was called The End of the Hamptons.
Yeah, great.
Scenes from the Class Struggle in mm-hmm. America's Paradise.
Yep.
This one is Kill It to Save It, and so an autopsy of capitalism's triumph over democracy. It does seem that almost all of my titles have some form of death in them, but that isn't necessarily, that's certainly symptomatic of a deeper disorder that I probably have. But
well, there's a lot of death and destruction, you know, the creative destruction of capitalism.
Exactly.
As they say, is causing a lot of death right now. And I see these things on Facebook over the last 48 hours about, Trump's killing me. I mean, people that are sick, I'm going to die now. It's really, really sad.
Well, and I think, you know, that is in some ways the kind of ultimate conclusion. George Reitzer calls it, the rationality of irrationalism, or the irrationalism of rationality. You know, you finally, in fact, if you read the last chapter, it's actually the moment that I thought of writing the book, when listening to an NPR story on the Czech Republic's attempt to ban smoking. And the idea that the government felt a public health policy that would save lives and save money would be, because they had essentially universal health care, they would try to ban smoking as a solution to health risks. And what happened was the tobacco companies, along with their accounting firm, Arthur Little, put out a study that suggested that, in fact, the country would save money if they promoted smoking. Between the money they
people
got...
People will die sooner?
Exactly. The money they would get from taxes, because they tax cigarettes, but also that people would die sooner.
God.
And if you think of, you know, kill it to save it, I don't think there's a more, you know, stark example than that. But, you know, certainly, you know, the Vietnam War, it was a perfect example, and kill it to save it really comes from that era.
Yeah. You know, before we go on, I want to also, and don't get too much of an ego over this, but I want to read your other...
Impossible.
What do you call it? The book jacket description, little bio. Corey Dolgan is professor of sociology and director of community-based learning at Stonehill College, Easton, Mass., USA. He is past president of the Association for Humanist Sociology, and has taught at Harvard and Clark Universities. Corey is the author of three other books, including the award-winning The End of the Hamptons, Scenes from the Class Struggle in America's Paradise. He has published many articles for anthologies, journals, and magazines. I think I've read some of your journal stuff, too, off and on, so that's great. Yeah, you're a very prolific writer. How do you find time? You've got two kids. How do you find time?
Well,
I want to know this.
I also have a spouse, and so she helps quite a bit. You know what? I've learned to write quickly in bursts and chunks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I am very fortunate. My family will give me 2 or 3 days retreat to catch up on things. And,
that's great.
And you know, I actually should say that I'm the past director of the center for the Office of Community-Based Learning and the Downtown Center for Community Engagement, which I would like to talk about a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever you want to talk about. This is your hour or hour and a half or 2 hours, whatever you want.
But I have, because of this book in particular and the next two books, which I've kind of stacked up, started writing the next one, I've kind of moved away from some of that community engagement work, which is very time-consuming but incredibly rewarding. But I think I'm looking to do a lot more public intellectual work and activism with my pen and my voice, and hopefully more public opportunities. I see the book talks. Anyone who's ever been to a book talk at a bookstore, and I'm only doing independent bookstores, I think those are the places where we should be putting our money. I highly encourage folks, if they're going to order books online, and I understand the ease, I do it myself, but I don't order them from Amazon anymore unless that's the only place I can get a book. You can go to the Harvard bookstore, you can go to great independent bookstores around the country. I've been to Elliott Bay Books in Seattle, Powell's in Portland, and I'm sure globally there are great independent bookstore still. Go to their online webpage and you can order any book pretty much that you would order on Amazon. Might cost a dollar or two more, but it's totally worth it to support these bookstores.
I agree. I don't use Amazon either. And I use the independent bookstore, but I've had to stop buying everything lately, except your book, because of financial troubles.
Oh, absolutely.
Like everybody else, I'm not going to.
Well,
just
you're
me,
welcome to come over and visit my library anytime. But I did want to say that I think the book talks, because, you know, maybe we sell 10 or 20 or 30. The other night we had, you know, over 50 people there.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, that's an engagement, right? That's an intervention. That's an opportunity.
It's organizing
to talk
in a way.
Yep. Exactly. And so I'm really looking forward to a new phase in some way, to start really doing much more public work through the book, through the singing lectures, and through the other things that I do.
Yeah. I mean, I spoke at a public meeting in Providence yesterday at a public library that Socialist Alternative put together on, you know, May, for, you know, International Workers' Day, Trump, and all that stuff. And, about 22 people showed up, and there were people in my organization, so sort of, that were disappointed because they've had better luck lately getting people. And I'm like, no, this is not bad. And the people there were very good, really good discussion. I'm like, this is organizing. It's grassroots organizing. I mean, it'd be nice if we could do 3 of these meetings at once.
Right.
But still, this is a start, you know. And they are new to this, you know. There's a fairly new organization there. And so I'm like, no, this is how it goes. Nothing goes in a straight line, up, 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 you know?
That's right.
You know?
And I think, you know, you've been doing this. We're both very old. we've been doing this a long time. I'm in the classroom more, and you're on the streets a little more. So, but in particular moments, there's a much greater opportunity to not just kind of spread the word, but give all the different aspects of organizing that are necessary right now. Political organizing is not only right now about convincing people that things are wrong, they know that, but it's about giving them a historical context, giving them a political analysis, or at least the tools to come to their own analysis, and really convince a lot of people, and that's really one of the messages of the book, that it's collective action right now.
Yeah.
Right? And the more we can dismantle the gross hyper-individualism rampant in our society that allows the corporate hegemony much of its power, certainly among the working and middle class, then we have done a great service to the revolution.
You must have heard of Derek Jensen, right? Mm-hmm. Down in Texas. I don't know what he's doing lately, but a few years ago he wrote a piece for Orion magazine, which I'm not even sure still exists, but it got picked up in a lot of other places.
Right.
It's called something like Forget Shorter Showers. And it's just the whole thing. And I like it in particular because he's a positive reference to the Russian Revolution. Like,
right.
So he's a little more than a liberal, you know, a little left of liberalism. And it's a whole thing about, he just gives the facts about where pollution really comes from. Big corporations and the military, not from what you do.
That's
so you
right.
can be as green as possible and the environment will stay as brown and degraded as much, as you know, more than ever.
No,
you know?
That's right. And think about how the environmental movement, in some ways, you know, ideologically was bought and sold by individualism.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And with the support of corporations, to be sure. There was an argument, I think people still use it, and I'm surprised they get away with it, but there was an argument that if you can convince people individually that recycling is important and get them in the habit of thinking differently about their environment, they will make that next step to a much more political, large-scale macro analysis of corporate environmental degradation. And it didn't work.
No.
In fact, it almost went in the opposite direction.
I think it might work with some people, but not mostly.
No, and I think recycling is really important.
Yeah,
I think all
of
these
course,
things are important, but we have to introduce it as part of a larger
thing. And it just doesn't make the impact we think it's making either, unfortunately. And, you know, I've even read stuff about, because I'm really into environmental stuff, and I've even read things like, oh, well, yeah, recycling has really picked up. Guess what hasn't? The number of recycling centers and the number of people they're willing to hire to take care of it. So they're dumping stuff. Oh, my God. Are you kidding? So anyway, let's get back to the main point here. Kill It to Save It. If you're just tuning in, if you're finishing up brunch or whatever, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy by Corey Dolgan. Corey's live in the studio here. Thanks for coming in, by the way. I hate the phone-in interviews. I just don't like them because sometimes they screw up and all that. So thank you for the drive.
I appreciate your compensating me for travel.
Yeah, I know. That's what did we agree to? I can't remember.
I think it was $8.75.
That sounds like a hamburger or
that's
something.
That's about
right. Anyway, so... like I said, I'm sorry, I only have only read one chapter, so I'm kind of in the same boat as maybe the listeners. What's this about? Like, what's the main... Well, I also had the advantage of being at the book talk, but what would you say, what's the blurb?
Yeah.
And then you can get more deeper. But what's the blurb for if you want people to go out, rush out and buy it?
Well, I'll give the concept and a little bit of the history. So the concept of Kill It to Save It comes out of a phrase used during the Vietnam War to describe the burning of villages and the mass killings of people to save the country. And so similar to the smoking idea that Vietnam would be saved when most of the population was actually killed or displaced. And at that point, the United States could step in and kind of reconstruct in much the same ways that they've done so successfully in the Middle East, I might add. So this notion of Kill It to Save It became something that I should give a shout out to my buddy Steve Corey, who on many occasions we would commute to Worcester State College together from Arlington, Massachusetts at the time, and kind of riff off the political situation of the time and say, well, that's Kill It to Save It. Oh, there's Kill It to Save It. And just the constant recognition throughout the 1990s and early 2000s that what was happening in public policy was the decimation of the idea of public. And so that not only was corporate hegemony taking over, but also this ability to convince people that corporate hegemony, what was good for business, was good for them, because it also came almost like sugar with medicine. It came with this kind of false hope of individual liberty. And so the libertarian, indoctrination with corporate hegemony and also with this kind of far-right fundamentalism created what I call this toxic blend of kill-it-to-save-it policymaking. And that's really the theory, which was to kind of look and see historically and theoretically how what most people, I think, on the left who are critical, but I think often without nuance, say, is that, oh, look how Americans are being duped. And I want to make the argument that it's not quite that simple because, as I say in the book, ideologies don't dupe people. And what we really need to look at is not so much what was false about these myths and these ideologies, but what was true. And if you get at, historically, the deep core of racism in our society, right, then you know that you can tap into that. Right, so it's not so much duping the white working class as it is working on their deep-seated racism that comes through this historical formation of American society. There's also an anti-racist core to this country that you can tap into as well, but it's not as profitable for corporations, or easy for politicians.
Well, let me just riff on a couple of points there. Sorry to interrupt, but you had some wonderful, what do you call them?
Blurbs.
Yeah. I'm using that word a lot today. Blurbs in favor of your book. So a provocative, thoughtful, and engaging book, a must read for people trying to find out what's that sound and what's not, what's going down. Rogelio Saenz from the University of Texas of San Antonio. I'm probably mispronouncing the name. Here's another one. Dolgan shows how capitalist hegemony and hyper-individualism reshaped America's national identity. Required reading for those hoping not only to resist Trumpism, but envision a new left for the 21st century. Eduardo Bonilla Silva, author of Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America. I really want to read that, by the way. I haven't.
It's a great book.
And then Robin D.G. Kelly, who I am a little familiar with, quote, to understand the popularity of Donald J. Trump and the prevailing logic that turns billionaires into job creators, unions into job destroyers, and climate scientists into godless communists, we need Corey Dolgan. Kill to Save It is mandatory reading if we are to replace the neoliberal common sense, quote unquote, with the radical possibilities of good sense. Robin D.G. Kelly, author of Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. So that's those were really good blurbs. I mean, you should be really proud of that. And
yeah, if blurbs made the book, I got very lucky.
We're helping them make the book.
That's right.
Right now. But I forgot what I was going to say about Robin D.G. Kelly. I mean, Hammer and Ho, of course.
Well,
I mean, I don't know what he's doing lately, though, to be honest.
Well, what's interesting about Robin's work lately is he's had two different places where he puts his focus on. One is he's been a significant part of the international scholarly work on Palestinian rights. And so he's been writing and helping to pass in various professional organizations support for BDS and a
case
variety of other things.
In case our listeners don't know, BDS is a boycott, divest, sanctions of Israel in general, products, intellectual or physical, and so on.
Right, and I think not only his name, but his writings have offered a lot of gravitas to that effort. And the other one is some really important writings on Black Lives Matter. And I cite in the book one of the pieces that he's done in trying to look at the impact of the evolution of broken windows theory, which is the theory that you can stop crime in a neighborhood if you can fix broken windows.
Stop and frisk emanates from that as well.
Well, exactly, and that's what even the even one of the original authors of Broken Windows, Kelling, I think it's George Kelling, but has written in the last few years that they never envisioned broken windows becoming stop and frisk, right? And so their ideas were about community policing, having police interact with people who live in a neighborhood and, what was off limits and what wasn't off limits, If people were sitting on their stoop drinking, that was fine, but they couldn't congregate, on the corner, things like that, which we could argue about the role of police in a community at that level, but certainly much more progressive than what it became, which was stop and frisk and a variety of other terrible violations.
Do you ever read Black Agenda Report at all?
Yeah,
I really like their analysis a lot. they're, you know, because they're the left of the Democrats working towards a new political party. And
that's true. But yeah. I have to say, and this is why, you mm-hmm. know, and this would be interesting for us to talk about, because mm-hmm. I think we agree more than we disagree on this. But I would say left of the Democrats now is a huge swath.
Yes, of course. You know, that is. Means a lot of different things. Yeah.
Exactly. And
just, you know, like the word, I was going to get into the word socialism, means a lot of different things right now.
No, that's right. Yeah. And actually, it may be healthy for socialism to see that there's actually this trajectory of socialism.
Right? Sure. So that we can, I think that's a given, actually.
Yeah. So we can start. Well, I think, obviously, in this country, the word socialist has been so stigmatized that it's always been one thing. Yeah. But if we can start at the right of socialism with Bernie Sanders, right? And then move, you know.
Well, let's talk about that, maybe. But let me just say one thing to define our terms. When I say Democrats, I don't mean Democratic voters. I mean the elites that control
right.
the party.
That's right.
And including the way to become an elite, by the way, in the Democratic Party is there's it's a very mysterious thing. It's not a membership party. You basically, if you run, one way to do it.
It's not mysterious at all. I'm showing Jeff the wad of bills
It's the money,
pocket.
But it's also, it has to be more than that, Corey. I'm sorry. But it's also running for office and getting the stamp of that's approval right. and working your way up that way, so to speak. I have a funny anecdote about Sanders. I should jump into it before I forget it, but we can circle sure. back around to it. I think Paul Street in Counterpunch wrote about this, mm-hmm. That a someone even more progressive than Sanders in terms of foreign policy and many local issues in Vermont, an African-American woman, wanted to run against him one year. I forget which. I think it might have been when he ran for Congress mm-hmm. as a Democrat. And Sanders had done this deal in, I don't know if you're aware of this, in 1992, he went to the Kennedy School, which is basically a Democratic Party think tank.
Right.
Did the deal, basically, with the Democratic Party elites that year, because he had just lost the race for governor not long before that. And he was devastated by that. Democrats kicked his butt after four terms as mayor and his profile extremely high in Vermont, and he lost. The Bernie magic didn't work, so he's really upset. He goes to the Kennedy School. He does a deal that if the Democrats run a national candidate, he will support that national candidate, which wasn't that much of a stretch because he'd already supported Mondale. A lot of people mm-hmm. don't know that, but he usually didn't. And then locally, they won't run against him.
Mm.
And there was probably some other stuff about committee assignments and stuff like that if he won. So he runs after that, wins, gets the Plum committee assignments for the Democrats, caucuses with the Democrats, and they both stayed true to the agreement. Of course, Sanders is much deeper in the party now. He's actually the best fundraiser among right. Democrats for Senate Democrats now. And so that agreement has stuck ever since. Now, before that agreement was known, this woman ran, I'm sorry, I forget her name, she ran against Sanders from the left,
mm-hmm.
but as a Democrat.
Right.
And the local Democratic Party would not touch her. They would not promote her. They would not let her on the platforms. They would not organize meetings for her. They would not give her any money. Nothing, 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 because they did that deal with Sanders
right.
that, you know, they're not going to go run against him. So I'm using that to illustrate something way beyond Sanders, which is you can run as a Democrat, but if you don't get the vote of approval of the money people,
right.
it's meaningless in some ways. I think it's I think it's not meaningless in the sense of you've locked yourself into an ideology and a path, maybe, that is, in my opinion, for corporations and against working people.
Right. Now, you, of course, recognize the irony of that, right?
Yes, it's contradictory, but
well,
it's
but
there.
Ultimately, Sanders loses for the same reason in the previous primary, right?
Because, you mean the recently?
Yeah, because he didn't have the stamp of approval of the Democratic leadership conference and the Democratic
Correct.
Party leadership.
Correct.
And in fact found himself not only outside of the money and resources, but actually having that money and resources put against him.
But see, at that level, though, you're absolutely right, but at that level there's another angle to this. They whether it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, they have to choose. And the capitalist class, as you know, is not a monolith, and they have to figure things out. The elites in the Democratic Party have to figure things out. And yeah, they had Hillary picked long before that, you know, the from the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration, to, you know, all the work she did as Secretary of State, et cetera. She was like their perfect candidate in many ways. And Sanders was not, you
right.
know, and he had. Now, this is the thing about Sanders that I find really funny. Everyone says the proud Democratic Socialist Party said Sanders stopped talking about Democratic Socialism a long time ago, only when the media brought it up at first to attack and then later to just, you know, place and to give some context. or still to attack if they say it just didn't grab people. People didn't say, "Oh, that commie," you know. So so it didn't become a big thing. But you'll notice Sanders doesn't open with that, talk about that. He doesn't use that term at all.
Kind of like Obama with race.
Well, yeah, but to his credit, he doesn't denounce it either.
Right.
But to his not credit, whatever the word's looking for. Remember that speech he gave that, like, a lot of people don't know about it, but he gave a big speech defining what democratic socialism was as he was running, and it became Lyndon Johnson, FDR, and JFK.
Right.
And that's not socialism, sorry. That's not even close. That's straight up imperialist, capitalist politicians in the Democratic Party. But, you know, most people didn't hear that, and there's still a lot of people that think he's a socialist, and that maybe gets into the point I was going to come in later with about socialism with you. But let's jump back. Let's recircle to...
Go ahead. One of the things about the... to go back
exactly.
to the book.
Exactly, yeah,
Because
that's what we're doing. Yep.
Why I'm here, although, you know, maybe I should come back and we'll just have an open conversation.
Well, I thought that was related to the book, but I do digressions quite a bit.
It is.
So I'm glad we're back to the book.
It is related to the book, because one of the things that I think people... who hear me talk or who are actually reading the book is that this was written with the assumption that Hillary Clinton would win the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so while I was able to make some changes towards the end, one of the things that, you know, I think the book makes pretty clear, whether I'm right or wrong, but at least it's clear in the book, that the ways in which the Democratic Party has moved makes this paradigm even more powerful. So my chapters on education, especially K through 12 education, are extremely critical of Obama and Arne Duncan and the rest of the Democratic folks when it comes to their educational policy, which essentially is neoliberalism. Essentially, it's, you know, kill the public sector of education and privatize, bring in charters, and
top. Can I do another digression?
Absolutely.
Were you aware of question 4 in Massachusetts much?
Is that charter
schools?
That
was the lift the cap on charter schools.
Oh, absolutely.
And they got hammered on that. I mean, meaning the people for it. And it was across the spectrum. Liberal radio, liberal TV. I mean, everybody was in favor. The Democrats were really in favor of it. Seth Moulton loved it, you know, all that stuff. And 64% voted against the charter cap. Or was it yes to stop the charter cap? Anyway, 64% voted to stop the charter cap. And my organization was slightly involved in that. We had one person, actually, it was his full time working on it in Worcester. And we were so happy about that.
I know.
And it was very popular to stop the charter school cap in Worcester. Although, interesting racial dynamics. There was a black activist in Worcester who I know fairly well. I've had political discussions with him. And he interpreted the whole thing as he's just so angry at the school system. He interpreted it as the white teachers trying to, and the union there had done a really good thing. They had gone out to the public with a public meeting at the public library, the main branch, to publicize early on this, how the dangers of this thing and how bad it was. And this guy showed up and basically blew up the meeting with just to save white teachers' jobs. And it was very nonsensical because, of course, the teachers are more diverse there than that. And he didn't want to listen to the analysis at all, and boom, you know, just a grenade and walk out. You know, it showed the way that issue is used just in a really nasty way. To, like, public education is so messed up, and most people, including teachers, won't go for the overarching analysis and how to solve it. So it leaves people fighting over scraps, and it's just the charter schools is just a race to the bottom, basically. Race
to privatization. That's right. And especially the research on raising caps, right? So the research on the more you allow charter schools and the faster they grow, the worse their results are. Now, they fail miserably in most places around the country anyway. But certainly the last thing you would want to do is raise the caps, because it just encourages some of the worst aspects of it.
Yep. You know, jumping a little bit here, you gave a good, solid, 15-minute reading at Harvard Square Bookstore. I don't think we can do that on the radio. It's not as compelling, believe it or not.
I mean,
you didn't think your reading was compelling, but people that face-to-face contact and the inflections and facial gestures and everything makes it more interesting than just reading a long quote. I know from hard experience here doing the show,
absolutely.
You can't read, you know, I can't come on here and read the entire Communist Manifesto. I mean, I could, but it wouldn't be that compelling.
Right, that's right.
So if you do have a quick quote, though, you want to read from that will give us a flavor of the book, that'd be cool.
Well, that's a good question. I wasn't prepared for that.
I know, because I kind of was mitigating against it in my mind. I was sort of like, let's not reading here.
I was just very excited to get a request from Alternet.
Okay.
Which is...
kind of know what that is.
Yeah, nowadays it's an online publication that will reprint progressive left articles and things, although they do have their own content as well. But they are going to reprint an excerpt from the book.
Nice.
And so I thought maybe I could read a couple of paragraphs.
Sure,
from there.
Tell me the page so I can follow.
So we're looking
on.
At 171. For those of you at home who have your hymnals, take out your hymnals.
Page 171. This is a long book too. I mean that in a good way.
Pages.
Wait, let me see. Shama Sawant. Let me look in the index. If you don't mention Shama Sawant, the interview's over, by the way.
It's over then. it's over.
That gets into something I want to talk about later.
It's over.
But
I do mention Gramsci a lot.
That does nothing for me, man. Gramsci was writing in code, for Christ's sake.
And in Italian. So this is section...
No Shama Sawant.
Called... It's
171, did you
171. It's called It's the Political Economy.
Yeah, I love
stupid.
That title. I noticed that. Yep.
And of course, that comes from James Carville's now famous quote, "It's the economy, stupid," was never meant to expose his or Bill Clinton's dour economic determinism. The true meaning of the phrase rests on the ambiguous pronoun. What is the it that is the economy? We know Carville's campaign mantra, the one he spouted in D.A. Pennebaker's documentary, The War Room, "Don't complicate the simple." But perhaps the opposite is true. It's the economy, stupid, simplifies something incredibly complicated and painfully raw. It represents a profoundly cynical sense of democracy and the structures and people that perversely control it. It stands for, quote, "What will convince the majority of poor working and middle class Americans to vote for our candidates, despite the candidates themselves being bought and sold by wealthy oligarchs?" It suggests a system subsidized by private interests that benefit from a democracy more about performance than policymaking. Perhaps it mollifies fears of economic instability or conjures false hopes of prosperity or feeds hungry voters who think things could get better if they support the right candidate, even though things could never really get much better under our current system. None of these its seems very inspiring, but Bill Clinton won twice.
Yeah, I somehow did read that last night. I thought I was reading the last chapter. I read that. That's. I totally agree with that. I would say maybe more simply, not as well. Correct me if I'm wrong. The it is the perception of the economy, and what can be done to help you as the victim of capitalism, globalization, etc.
I think that's pretty accurate. It essentially suggests that, you know, democracy is the retail sales aspect of democracy, but it's a very individual one that's based on convincing you that things can get better if you vote the right way. But, you know, people would vote for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump with that same sales pitch, right? And so the question to me is, and this is what's, you know, I talk a little bit about the media. One of the critiques of the book so far that I think is a powerful one is I don't spend enough time on the media. Probably could have had a whole chapter.
Disagree with that. After I read it, I would predict I'll disagree with that because there's so much media critique from the left.
And that's
it's overkill.
That's right.
It's overkill.
That's right. Not to use the term "kill" too much, but
yeah.
But
kill
but,
media critique to
right.
save it.
But that is one of the reasons why I didn't do it mm-hmm. because I thought there was so much about that. But certainly it would fit in this narrative with more attention. But the notion that nowadays politics, electoral politics in particular, but even, you know, issue politics, are so focused on the media message that there's never any education, right? So the idea of actually trying to put forward something that might be a little bit more than "it's the economy, stupid," right, suggests that, well, you can't sell that, so people won't listen and people won't buy. And the more you continue the media maelstrom of 24/7 messaging, that I would argue, regardless of what station you're watching on television, you know, unless you get Democracy Now or something like that, there are very few even cable stations that you can find that go further than the Democratic center or the right wing of the Republican Party.
Well, you're actually on a show right now that's a little tiny, 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 tiny piece.
That's right.
Of, I think, unique programming, because we do often, I mean, we just start from a place to the left of the Democrats that you're just not going to hear. I mean, there are some obviously progressive radio shows on, usually the left side of the dial where the college stations are, not with not great signals. This one's okay. But that people feel the need to do the shows to do sort of a alternative information, alternative media thing, but they feel constrained. This is my subjective opinion. They seem to feel constrained to keep to rules that were set up by professional corporate media. And I don't feel constrained by those rules. And we just go, yeah, we're socialists, we're pro-union, we're partisans in the class struggle. Screw you, listen or turn it on. You know what I mean? That's where we start from here. Now, you just said something, though, that had two aspects to it. What was the last point? You don't expect the Democratic Party, though, to do that education that you're talking about. I mean, one thing is the dumbing down of America and all
that's right.
But the other hand is, who's going to really do education as part of organizing? It's not going to be the Democratic Party.
Let me suggest this. It will never be the formal Democratic Party. There may be candidates.
Or the corporate media.
Right. There may be candidates that run as Democrats in local elections. And I totally understand that people feel constrained to make decisions on party affiliation. When I ran for office back in 1992, it was as an independent against an incumbent Democrat. If there had been no Democrat running, I don't know that I would have said, you know, I couldn't go on two or three different lines. I might have accepted that nomination. But, you know, as you suggested, when you accept the Democratic Party designation, if in fact you decide that you want the resources of that party, you start to make deals. So I think it's highly unlikely that you'll find people run as Democrats and maintain a really solid left progressive message that doesn't try to equivocate at some point. But having said that, yeah, we need to educate people. You know, I'm hoping this book is one aspect of that much larger process. You know, again, I would love for people to not only listen to your show and hear about the book, but hear about your message, you know, every week about a variety of issues. I know you've been really strongly an advocate for, you know, universal health care and single payer for decades. I think that's one of the first
issues. I'm actually not personally, but Social Alternative and myself personally, we do use these terms like universal health care, single payer, and all that, but really we're after socialized medicine.
Correct. That's right.
Human right. No, health care is a human right. Shouldn't be making profit off sick people. End of story.
You know? That's right.
But,
well, you know, and this is where I think the left ought to be able to come together on the message here, and it's slightly mentioned in the book, but it will definitely be a part of one of the new books I'm working on called War on Wealth.
That's the working title?
Yeah.
Nice.
Working title. Mm-hmm. The idea that there are basic human rights that have been outlined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and you know, we can quibble with that document too, but the idea that food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, and education are basic human rights and ought to be available to every human being. And I have to say that even considering myself a socialist, I'm not, you know, I talk about independent bookstores. I don't have an issue with people selling things and making enough money for them to live on over and what the cost of what they're selling is. I have no problem with people coming up with ideas and being quote-unquote entrepreneurs. I just don't think that we should run a society based on that principle.
Well, why can't people do like, who was it that discovered the polio vaccine?
Salk, I think.
Why couldn't Salk?
Probably ripped it off from somebody.
No, well, yeah, okay, that's another thing. The great man theory of history. Right, right, I'm right. buying into it for a second. Right. But who got credit that's for right. discovering the polio? Jonas Salk. He immediately turned that over to the government. He didn't try to make money off
it. No, that's
it.
Right.
Didn't Tesla do some things like that as well?
Absolutely.
There's a whole other paradigm. Of,
no, that's right.
You know, and it, you know, don't get me started, but I actually had this in my head during your book talk, or maybe no, maybe it was from the meeting yesterday. Somebody was going on about, you know, the human nature argument.
Oh, please, yeah.
And, well, there's a lot of psychological studies recently that I've seen through the, even through the corporate media or the alternative media, that show the natural default position of human beings is actually sacrifice and altruism and solidarity. And it's, and there was this one study where it was actually, well, rich people weren't acting that way, but everybody else in the study was.
Right.
You know, I mean, I really feel that. I mean, if you think about what people do for their families and what they do for other people, ends up taking up a lot more time in many cases than the way they're exploited. But also another angle on what you just said, are socialists against people coming up with ideas or selling things? The answer is no.
Yeah, that's right.
But there is this line, and Marx drew the line perfectly, in my opinion. He, and I don't have the quote memorized, but something like, we're not against people having property or something like that. We're against and acquiring things, but we're against exploiting labor to acquire those things.
That's right. And I mentioned it in the book, in fact, in the first section where I talk about what an economy is, right?
I wish I had read that.
The point of an economy, as a sociologist, is to produce and distribute the goods necessary for survival, right? And so any economy that doesn't do that, it seems to me, is not a functional economy. So, could capitalism become the economy that does that? I highly doubt it. We don't have any examples. We have examples of of kind of democratic, socialist, capitalist countries trying to do that with a welfare state. They do it better than we do, but they don't do it effectively enough.
Yeah.
So the question becomes to me, what makes the most functional economy that really does distribute this, not based on someone's individual talent, individual skill, but just by the very basic fact that they're a human being? And that to me, socialism has a much better answer. Than anything
else. Is it too divergent from the book to take up that point for a second of I'm rephrasing that in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism works. Like you right. can actually find people from the right, even some liberals probably, saying that, oh, well, living standards are the highest they've ever been on a world scale. And look at all these people in China that are entering the middle class and in India and all that. And this is extremely a one-sided false picture of what's going on. Even in mm-hmm. the richest country in the world, you have here,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you have a decline in living standards,
mm-hmm.
more people living in precarious existence, more
Absolutely.
People living paycheck to paycheck, more people having no idea how they're going to pay for their children's higher education, which is necessary now to get any sort of job, we're told, et cetera, et cetera. So, if you want to talk about capitalism working, then you have to just take big chunks of reality and ignore them, like climate change, global warming, places where capitalism doesn't even function anymore, Sudan, and various places.
Friedman's
it
had
works,
to qualify.
Quote unquote. Come on.
Even Thomas Friedman's had to qualify his, unrelenting and unrestricted, belief in the greatness of global capitalism because of its destruction of the planet. Now, he may think carbon tax is the answer and we can then solve all the problems.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right.
It's not
right.
just global warming either, though. I mean, I just heard something. I've heard some good stuff recently. I'm happy I'm not the only person talking about this, because sometimes I feel like I am. Although my organization, or Social Alternatives, is against nuclear power, and of course, talks about the danger of nuclear war. But I feel like that's fallen off the radar a little bit. But there's people that are still like, no, wait a minute, with all this, with Trump in power and with North Korea and all this, nuclear war still an extreme danger.
Absolutely.
But also the again back to environmentalism, the range of pollution that's hurting humanity goes beyond global warming, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Into basic things like, plastic is now showing up in 60% of beach sand, showing up in infants and in animals, et cetera. And nobody's got, under capitalism, you cannot develop a plan to get rid of plastic. It just won't work. That, little places might, But you know, the competition will come out with cheap plastic and run with it in places
that
won't
be able to do it. Well, then the competition is the issue, right? Because capitalism, sure, theoretically, is based on the sensibility, or at least certainly the legitimacy of it is based on the idea that competition, right, will eventually solve these problems.
And it's absurd.
And it is absurd, yeah, because, you know, unless we completely restrict the power of corporations to determine any policy whatsoever, which would be in some ways antithetical to the way we think of democracy right now,
yep,
then you won't have people coming up with alternatives to fossil fuels or plastics or any of the other major global corporations.
Well, it's not fashionable or probably even allowed in certain places, but you know, when this discussion starts to come up in various forms, I say, hey, did you ever read Imperialism by Lenin? Because way back, Lenin took a lot of studies, brought them together and said, monopolization is not resulting in an easier controlled capitalist economy or less competition. It's competition at a higher level. So at the time he was writing, electrical production was basically divided up into two companies, a German company and an American company, because, you know, it was a smaller market but still huge at the time. And that was it. And electric prices weren't falling and things were not good, and there were a lot of people without electricity. There's a lot of exploitation, a lot of pollution, blah, blah, blah. You know, so, sorry, you know, Lenin and others have studied this and said, wait a minute, either through monopolization you don't reach this some accidental plan, or through breaking up companies and creating false, you know, competition. This wasn't so much in imperialism, but in other things,
right,
I've read, where, and I've seen it in my own life, they break up monopolies, quote unquote. How long does it take to remonopolize? 5 years, 10 years? Look at the airlines. There's what, four now? You know, anyway, that is a digression again.
But
I had an idea.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, going back to the discussion of socialism, and, mm-hmm, and again, partly, yep, partly directly linked to the book, is the trajectory, the span, the landscape for political discourse has significantly constricted in the last 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And you know, we can talk about Bernie Sanders again, maybe opening that up a little bit. But the idea that FDR, JFK, Lyndon Johnson, you know, were socialists, in my class, I often play the FDR broadcast about the Second Bill of Rights, and you know, where he talks about education and health.
Is that the one where he said all the Japanese in the West Coast need to go into concentration camps?
No, I'm just kidding.
Go ahead.
No. you know, I'm not saying that he wasn't a racist, but what I'm suggesting is that, you know, this Second Bill of Rights, which at the time fit squarely within the ideology and the rhetoric of the Democratic Party. The, you know, Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty speech, you know, fit directly within the Democratic Party's language, which seems so...
I'm going to, as the academics say, push back in a minute, but
okay,
go ahead.
But, so what has happened in 50 years has been so constricted and pushed to the right, in some ways to the extreme right, right? That, you know, Obamacare had trouble getting passed by a Republican Senate and Congress when it was a Republican policy from 20 years previous, right? That when Sanders says, well, look, these people were socialists, to the American public, they were. Now, I'm not going to suggest
that's
that
a problem.
But think of the landscape when FDR was giving this speech on the Second Bill of Rights. There was a really active socialist party. There was a really active left critique.
You're pushing me into a big pushback in a second.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess I would suggest that one of the things that is, I think, is possible now that we need to do more of is continue to give a much more radical socialist perspective and analysis, and be able not to make connections with, you know, FDR and LBJ, but to resurrect, right, the real socialist core of American political discourse that goes back to the 19th century.
So here now you're going to accuse me of misrepresenting what you're saying somewhat, because I haven't read the book.
Don't tell me what I'm going to do yet.
But let's just keep to the facts. You played to your class a progressive speech by FDR.
Right.
maybe you gave the context for other things on that. Or Sanders, you've just spoken somewhat favorably of Sanders making connections with the Democratic Party at a time when it was supposedly more progressive.
Not favorably, but I'm trying to explain why.
Oh, okay.
Why I think it works.
Works how? What do you mean by works?
Well, I think it works.
It works to reach people just becoming interested in something to the left of right wing?
I think it works for Sanders within the
Democratic Party to create a sense of legitimacy and legacy.
It is a Democratic Party legacy that he's trying to recapture, that there was a lefter part of the Democratic Party.
Let's use the academic speak again. It's a false narrative. I mean, really, really horribly a false narrative, because let's look at Roosevelt for a second. That aside, that, oh yes, he was a racist, is the deeper you look into, the deeper you look into Roosevelt and the New Deal policies, the way they were cut off from black people,
was a part
of the whole Jim Crow, keep the South Democrat thing, even
nope,
then.
That's right.
And that was horrific.
They were cutting deals.
That was horrific.
Absolutely.
And really set back for the working class, and I would include black workers or people that wanted to work in the working class, that was just devastating in the midst of the Depression. Then there's the more kind of well-known fudging that Roosevelt did with the, you know, he'd get elected, you know, he got reelected four times, as you know. So after he'd get reelected, he would cut the WPA programs.
That's right.
Keeping the WPA program paid lower in the South than in the North, limiting those programs, and him boasting openly and sometimes pleading, why are you guys mad at me? Because there was, like, the right wing did hate him. The far right did hate him.
Right.
I'm here to I'm saving capitalism for you.
That's Reich's book,
and he really was.
Yeah.
He really was.
Yeah.
But also that pressure of a big socialist party. It was actually a big communist party that by 1938 or 39 had 100,000 members and control over 49% of the CIO unions,
which
had just exploded out of nowhere in that decade. So this was a movement that I have trouble imagining.
Right.
You and I, same age practically, right?
Yeah.
So
you just look a lot older.
I look really old. So we've never, as I said on the air, I'm an older dad in quotes, right? So I go to get my daughter at school, who's six.
And
little kids say, is that your grandfather?
Yes.
I love that.
Same here.
Yes, I am.
That's right.
So anyway, the point is, you made me lose my point.
I think I've got your point.
No. It was further. I lost it. Go ahead.
Well, so you had talked to, you had ended before the self reference.
The grandpa.
That I forced you to move towards. The idea that there was this incredible real left, communist, socialist.
Oh, yeah, movements. Let me finish my thought then.
Okay.
We've never lived through that. Now, I've had people in Social Alternative and the Committee for Workers International that we're in solidarity with internationally who have lived through that stuff in South Africa and other places. And they said, this is what a mass movement is like. You slog away for years. Here's the most fun, the funniest way it was described to me. Did the Derry Uprising 1968 or 9 in Northern Ireland, CWI section there, not, you know, in doing Labour Party work, union work, but not growing much. All the left, including Bernadette Devlin, believe it or not, embraces the British troops coming in to protect the Catholics. Our organization at the time said, no, this is not going to work. Now, we don't get everything right or anything, but we got that one right. It's not going to work. It's bringing in British imperialism. We can form self-defense based on the unions, which were integrated, blah, blah, blah. But just the whole atmosphere of the Derry Uprising, once it took off, was months before, or weeks before the Derry Uprising, you'd put up leaflets all over the town city center for a public meeting, even on something very compelling, you know, anti-Catholic terror or whatever. And, you know, three people would show up.
Right.
Then the Derry Uprising hits. Literally 1,000 people will cram into a little room for a meeting. They'll be out in the hallway. They'll be down the stairs. They'll be listening through the windows. That's really happened. We'd led this thing. I'm just using examples I'm very familiar with. It's not just our organization, obviously. So we led this thing called the anti-poll tax movement in Britain. Became a mass movement in the 90s. Thatcher's step too far.
That's right.
That started up in Scotland. We'd go into these little towns in Scotland and think, is anyone going to show up? We put up some, I mean, we had an organization in Scotland, but it was based in the city. So we got these little towns and put up some leaflets. Have they even heard about the poll tax yet? Hundreds of people showed up. We had anti-poll tax unions formed overnight, spread like wildfire across the country. Now, you and I have not lived through that. There's some, you know, Occupy was interesting, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. These are not really mass movements. They're very important and very positive in a lot of ways, but they never reached that level where the average person was compelled to deal with politics.
No, that's right.
Waiting for that. Not waiting passively, but can't wait for that to happen. I think it will happen.
That's right. Howard Zinn used to say, you know, you keep lighting sparks, you don't know where the fire is going to start.
That's a great metaphor.
I think Occupy Wall Street was important in many ways. It kind of softened a little bit the class rhetoric.
Do you remember that time? I'm sorry to interrupt. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, and I think Black Lives Matter has done that, although I think it's been a little bit more successful in organizing some institutional structure to continue. And so
you think so?
Well, I think...
That's debatable. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of Black Lives Matter material. There's still meetings. There's still, presence at
that's
demonstrations.
True.
Whereas, you know, Occupy, by the nature of what it did, you know, couldn't continue after it wasn't occupying anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, the name itself suggested it had a shelf life. But I think your point, which I think actually wasn't all that much different from mine, is that when you had these real left mass movements, particularly through the labor movement,
that forced
that
period, liberals to save capitalism.
That's
it wasn't their idea.
No, that's right.
Roosevelt ran as a Hooverite conservative when he first ran for office.
No, that's absolutely right. And so I think what I'm suggesting now is that I think